Welcome to the Being Human podcast, brought to you by Relate Malaysia. Join us in our conversations about what makes us human and why we think and behave in the ways that we do. We'll talk about mental health, emotional well-being, and how we can sometimes feel on top of the world, and other times like life calls for a large tub of ice cream and a big spoon. So come on in, relax, and let's explore this puzzle of being human together.
Hello and welcome to the Being Human podcast. My name is Dr. Chua Sukning, and today I'm joined by multi-award winning artist, radio and TV host, and mental health advocate, Sarima Ibrahim. Sarima has had a remarkable career, enjoying success in music and her debut album, Sarima, in 2001, which won her the Best Breakthrough Artist at the AIM Awards the following year. She was also enthusiastically butting into her own introduction. So she's already here.
So never want to stay far away from making it known that I'm here.
Okay, but I'll go through it because it is very impressive. So in 1998, she became the first female host of the Disney Channel and later hosted the first season of The Biggest Loser Asia. She later showcased her talents further by joining popular breakfast shows as a radio announcer for Red FM and Mix FM radio stations. So in 2017, she became the first Malaysian celebrity host to have her own talk show, The Sarima Show, which aired during prime time on TV3. And recently, she has been starring in the Astro original TV series ABBA, Next Door and Riot. She's also the patron of NIAWA, a youth-led mental health organization. So today, we will be discussing a crucial topic, peripartum depression, which affects 1 in 8 women in Malaysia during the peripartum period. And this is the period between pregnancy and up to a year after childbirth. And so despite these high numbers, Malaysia's health services are inconsistent in terms of clinical management, and healthcare is limited in treating expecting and new mothers with depression. Less than 30% of maternity healthcare providers screen for peripartum depression, and few mothers are offered any form of mental health care. And as a passionate mental health advocate and a mother, Sarima will be sharing her insights and experiences, shedding light on this important issue and the urgent need for adequate support and treatment in Malaysia. Welcome to the show, Sarima. How are you?
I'm very, very well. Thank you so much. Now, I don't know what to call you because when I meet you, I call you something else. So what do I call you now?
You can, Your Highness?
No, what do I call you?
Yeah, I know. Sickening is good. You just call me Sickening. So let's start with something general. You're a mother of one.
A four-year-old toddler who thinks she's 45.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And yes. What are your thoughts, I mean, generally, on the accessibility of mental health care in Malaysia to new mothers?
It's terrible. There you go. We can wrap up the podcast right now. Let's do it. It's terrible. Goodbye.
Yes. So tell me, have you had experiences seeking out mental health care in Malaysia? I mean, how do you know it's terrible?
Okay. Let's see how we can rephrase that into... The resources are there, the knowledge and support for utilizing the resources are terrible, just to correct, any misunderstandings that come from that. Because the last thing I want to do is belittle or undermine the efforts that have been made by people like yourself and many of the NGOs and a lot of the healthcare providers are trying their best to actually make a change. It's just that in a larger scale, we're talking, getting into the grassroots mindset, changing culture, changing understanding, financial support. That's where I would probably use the word terrible in the terms of how it's being implemented on a larger scale, perhaps by the government, itself. Again, I'm not undermining the government's efforts. I'm just saying that the implementation of these good intentions to help women and to help, improve our health as a nation are just, it's just not up to par to where it could and should be, I believe. And that's only from my own personal experience as having had postnatal depression, possibly perinatal depression. It's just that I wasn't perhaps
50%
aware.
50% of moms with postnatal depression, also or known as postpartum depression, actually, you know, their depression started during pregnancy.
Exactly. And it's just, you know, are we able to spot those coping mechanisms or signs and symptoms? But back to answering this question of yours, unfortunately, is a very long answer. I mean, I'm answering it as a mother, as a person who studied psychology, as a person who is very informed about trauma and compassionate therapy, as a person who was born overseas but raised in Malaysia, went to Sekolah Rendah. I have no, I've pretty much experienced life from a Western perspective and also very much a Malaysian perspective. And I understand both cultures and their understanding of perinatal, postnatal, and depression in general to be quite subpar and substandard compared to the rest of the world. So I'm wondering where our mistakes are at their core. Is it the education in primary school that we actually need to be discussing, even though our topic today is perinatal support and screening and, you know, looking at improving that? Is the actual issue something that we need to sort of go back and look deeper at and look at, the youth, so that, you know, anyone who becomes a parent, and that's most of us, not to say all of us, most of us who wish to be, have that education and understand it before they're even put into a situation, because prevention is always better than cure.
So you're really pointing out maybe the larger system needs a lot of work. And I agree with you, you know, we have come a long way, but there's always work to be done. I mean, there are no perfect systems. I
want to
bring you back and maybe explore what you just mentioned very briefly. And you've had perinatal depression, or you said postpartum depression. And so I'm guessing, so after the birth of your daughter.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, you know, as a performer, it's very hard to sort of diagnose when the point of, worrying, clinical depression or anxiety actually kicked in. Because when you live in a job that is not sitting by the desk and it involves, you know, being hyper, drinking copious amounts of coffee and entertaining everyone else and putting everybody else's needs before yours, and living in an acceptable environment of, you know, body shaming, etc., it's quite hard for me to be able to pinpoint to you and say, you know, exactly where my mental health started to go downhill. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, I mean, for a normal job person who's not an entertainer or performer, I somehow think that they might be a little bit of an advantage in the sense of being able to figure it out or categorize and say, okay, this is me when I'm kind of normal, and this is me when something's off. Whereas when you're an entertainer or performer of any sort, it's constantly adrenaline and cortisol and go, 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 go. And to the point that you never really can see. There's like a blurring of self and performer that happens. So maybe because my daughter was born just before COVID, and having that pantang period where you basically confinement, where you're sitting at home, removing the performer aspect of my life actually allowed me to, for the first time in my life, 100% see myself just as a human woman. And when that happened, when the removal entirely of the performer, I won't say facade, but part or focus on the performer aspect of my personality and being and work, I was left only with myself, my scars, my healing, my bleeding, my feelings, my tears, and an amazing new human being to take care of. And when you put a person in that situation really fast, which with so much change, biopsychosocial, you name it, it's really a shock to the system. So whatever predisposition I may have had, or even was suffering from, did not come to light, is what I'm saying, until I had that moment at home alone with me, where I was able to actually feel and be present with myself for the first time. And I think that's why I felt it. I felt the severity of my panic attacks that grounded me, literally floored me. I fell to my knees and I couldn't breathe, and I had to seek out the help of a mental health provider. And my therapist was on the phone with me for an hour trying to calm me down and ground me, because I could not breathe. And I could not, it was just an impending sense of doom that hit. And it was, strangely, it was 2 months after she was born. So what the heck was I doing for survival in 2 months that I didn't realize? I tell you what it was: not sleeping, pumping as much milk as I could, waking up at ungodly hours, having a strange fluctuation of hormones, not knowing who I was anymore, not knowing what was going to happen to me the next day or tomorrow, or if my child would stop breathing in the middle of the night, thoughts of joy and thoughts of doom existing at the same time, wondering if my marriage would ever be the same again, and wondering what my role was as a human and as a member of society and as a performer. When you put all that together in a bowl of, warm, hot boiling soup, it could be a recipe for disaster. And I think I just flipped one day. And it's funny, because what caused me to flip was going to watch a movie. It was my first date night out. And my husband and I said, well, we'll let the babysitter take care of her. And I thought I was fine. And I got to the cinema, and of all films, I had to watch my favorite actor, Joaquin Phoenix, the Joker. And the moment I could see on screen that he had lost his mind because of his trauma, I actually ran out of the cinema for the first time in my life. I ran out and I couldn't breathe. And I said to my husband, we need to go now to the hospital or to a doctor. I don't feel okay. And that was the night that changed everything for me. And it was a deeply transformational period. And that happened 4 years ago. I thought I wasn't going to survive, to be honest with you. I thought, there's no way I'll ever be able to, at this age, at this point, as a 41-year-old mother, performer, human being, I don't think I'll ever be able to go back to being me, and therefore I'm too lost. So I immediately started, and I'm very fortunate to be able to do it, intense therapy with a therapist 3 times a week. And I had to immediately start medication for 6 months. And I balanced out the biological part of myself first, like my brain, calm things down. And again, once I was able to calm down my mind and body, then my emotions and my consciousness sort of settled into this newness, new body, new life, new human being to take care of, new everything. And I became sort of reborn. It's funny, through the birth of my daughter, I became reborn.
There's a lot to unpack then. I know it's It was a difficult experience, and difficult experiences, as much as you process it, are not always easy to talk about. One of the things you mentioned was during that period you had, it sounded like you had a lot of thoughts running through your head and a lot of questions. And, you know, sometimes people who are not acquainted with depression and so from the outside, and they say, well, isn't that just you overthinking?
Thinking.
You know, and maybe if you stop thinking so much, you wouldn't be depressed. You know, and just from your perspective, how did that, you know, do you think that would have helped if you maybe you just kept yourself more busy, right? And you never had that sense of being alone, and then you would have been fine.
Well, that's the thing. We can't stop thinking till we're dead, right? Or we're knocked out or we're in a coma. And thinking happens. Thinking is not decided upon. Thinking, whether it's consciously or even subconsciously, happens, right? I'm thinking now and you're thinking and the listeners are thinking, but their subconscious is also thinking for them. Is that overthinking or is that just reality? Mm. You know, and I believe that it's true, as you said, you know, and as I mentioned, keeping busy for 25 years of your life in constant films, shoots, shows, rehearsals, exercising, in and out of, you name it, like, all different sorts of jobs that I was doing, martial arts, jumping out of planes for magazine features, you name it. I mean, there was never a time for me to even pay attention to my subconscious or myself or even to my own thinking. So I think overthinking kicks in when you've never been able to think. or be aware of your own thinking. And that's what I mean by the time spent alone is very scary for a lot of parents. Because when you finally are grounded, and that's what happened during COVID. And, you know, my daughter was born just before COVID. So lovely, right? I mean, it's like, oh, you're not alone enough. We're going to give you an entire world that doesn't let you go out, right? So I really got it. I mean, when it rains, it really pours. But, you know, even rain, even storms have a reason and a purpose too. So it cleans away the old and gives space for the new to come out and be seen and grow. And that's what happened. And I mean,
that's the meaning making that you can refer to of it, right? Like having lived through that experience and looking back, and it's almost like you've noticed, hey, something good came out of it. But during that time,
it was just
awful, right? It was like it was a really difficult period. I want to say what you said really, I think, resonated of when you just keep busy, and often that's also avoiding yourself, right? Avoiding spending time with yourself, it'll come crashing down. It'll catch up with you. Even if it wasn't the birth of your daughter, somewhere, somehow.
Exactly.
We can't keep, right? I mean, we age, right? Sometime we're going to slow down.
You can't stop life from happening.
Right. And everything we've been carrying and accumulating, the experiences, the difficulties, the emotions, if we don't clear it through processing it, looking at it, experiencing it, it piles up.
Exactly.
And I guess during the time with your birth of your daughter, that's when, as you said, it started raining and then COVID, and that was the thunderstorm for you.
And, you know, I don't think it's got anything to do with who you are, what your status is, what you do, you know, for a living. When you've fallen into that point where you're in I had basically severe anxiety disorder. I was like, damn. You know, I saw two doctors and both of them just looked at me and went, And I was like, that's really not helping my sense of ominous doom, you know. But I also appreciated their honesty. And I was very resistant to taking any medication at that time, 4 years ago. I was like, no way, I am not going to become dependent. Don't even suggest it, I said. And they were like, wow, your resistance to being given help is pretty high. And I was like, yeah, I don't want to become a victim. And that was quite also a huge upheaval for me, because I had a struggle, an inner struggle with the old me and the new me. The old me saying, no, you're so strong, you can do this, snap yourself out of it. Fine, if you're going to overthink good things to narrow out the overthinking. Oh my God, it was like my brain did everything it could. It was like, breathe now, do meditation, do your prayers, do this, do that. Now go for a run. Go. I actually did runs up and down a hill when I was having a panic attack one day, thinking that, because this is the only way I could distract myself from feeling like I couldn't breathe, right? Rather than take a little bit of medication, and this is me, like anytime I've got a headache, take a Panadol or whatever, you know, no worries. But take something to help myself from feeling like dying? Cannot. I got to be a hero. Finally, I gave in. Because you can only run up and down a hill in the hot sun so many times. Your body goes, mm-hmm. Your body says, no, that's not happening, Sarimai. Now you can't breastfeed because you've exhausted yourself. So I was like, you know, this is not working. This denial of needing help is not working. And I was fighting with that. I'm like, but you're in therapy. The therapy should be enough. You're taking care of your body. It should be enough. It should. And my subconscious was going, no. You know, medication and doctors exist for a reason. If you were bleeding to death right now, would you take something to stop it? Yes. So you are bleeding emotionally to death right now.
And why do you think it was so hard for you? I mean, because I consider medication, I know a lot of new moms or, you know, pregnant moms are resistant to that or reluctant. I think there's a lot of fear to take medication. Now, I would say that medications are not your, it's not the first tier treatment for perinatal depression. It is therapy, but, you know, some people need medication to help the efficacy of therapy and to improve. And a lot of research has shown that is relatively safe. And you, of course, you're monitored by your psychiatrist.
Yes.
you know, bad side effect, you go back to your psychiatrist and they'll look at the medication piece. But so for someone who's you know, you study psychology, you've gone for therapy.
Exactly.
And then why do you think there was that resistance for you? You know, why was it so difficult?
Again, my own, how would you say, prejudice towards and lack of compassion for myself, and thinking if I do take anything, I can't breastfeed my daughter anymore. This is the end. I'll not be a good mother. She doesn't get my breast milk. She'll never be healthy. She's like so healthy right now. She's like taller and heavier than all the children in her class and her age range. But at the time, I didn't know that. I had this thought like, oh my God, my child's going to be undernourished, malnourished, because, you know, you just go thinking the worst. And I was like, yeah, but you know, it's only 3 months. And if I stop breastfeeding. So what I did was, of course, being the overachiever, I pumped for like 4 months worth of milk just so I could feel better about myself. And pumping that much can drain you. And I was crying through it. This is the whole process. This is how it can get. And still resisting the medication because I don't want to take meds while I'm pumping milk, you know. And I'm like, doctor, I need to stack up. And doctor's looking at me going, okay, we'll go at your pace. We'll go at your pace. Don't worry. We'll go at your pace. And I'm going, no, you don't understand. You're not a woman, blah, 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 right? And then finally, after I'd pumped myself almost to oblivion and felt like, okay, at least I gave her 7 months of breast milk, now I can finally take something. So even through the postnatal depression and severe anxiety, I still was trying to fight through it. So there's no such thing as it's the easy way out. And I said, I think I was most resistant, A, because of the breastfeeding thing, but secondly, because the concept of becoming, in my mind, an addict, you know, because there's this perception that, you know, once you're on it for life kind of thing. And I think that really poisoned my mind because I've known of many people who've been in that situation. And it's so stupid for me to think that way at that time, because these people are living very satisfying, productive. They're thriving in their lives. And I'm sort of judging them going, oh, but you're thriving because you have help. And it's like, well, aren't we getting help every day? We get in the car rather than walk 20 kilometers. The car is there to help us. We take certain medications for migraines or headaches because we don't want. We get anesthesia when we're going to have surgery. We don't sit through surgery like the olden days. I will go through this. If there's no need to suffer in society, I wonder why we have this sense and need to suffer as a badge of honor or sort of like, you know, I suffered, therefore I am worthy. And I think I very much carried that with me. And
so I've internalized that value of...
Yes.
Yeah, right.
The belief system that I can get therapy every day if needed. I could tell everybody about my issue, but no. Don't you dare go and try take any meds, sorry, mom, because that means you are really weak. So I had to overcome that. That battle was bigger than the battle to breathe for me some days. So finally, when I got the help, I remember 3 days into having a low dose. It's so strange because low dose medication just to help your anxiety calm down so you can actually, you know, enjoy life and start enjoying your child. And I'm there going, no, I've swallowed this tablet. This is the end of me. When in actual fact, it just helped me to access me again. And I remember taking it and going, hey, how come I can focus on my daughter now? How come I'm not crying like every half an hour? Whoa. How come my therapy is helping me now? How come I can eat again? Hey, you know, it was a gradual, like over a 2 week period going, whoa. It's like my whole life kicked back into HD. You know, when you go to the cinema and it goes surround sound. And then you're like, whoa, that's loud. Well, life hit me. It's like I woke back up again. Amazing, right? And then from there on, I just rediscovered myself again in a more step-by-step, more full of gratitude, because then I was like going slower. And then I could see my daughter, my life, my job, my colleagues, everything became different in a good way for me. But my God, that took 6 months of hell. And then finally I could wean off and then, you know, continue the therapy, which I do. And sometimes if I feel like I've had too many coffees or I'm feeling a bit panicky before a job or something big, I just take a deep breath, I do some breathing exercises that I've learned and some vagus releasing sort of exercises, vagus stimulating. And then Vagus is in, not Las Vegas. Yeah, some people will be listening to this going, what are you talking about? Vagal nerve. There's actual exercises. And it basically activates the calming way of responding in your body. And then I'm okay again. And if I had known what I know now 20 years ago, that's it. I would have like maybe a few Oscars. Because, you know, sometimes when you're running on adrenaline and cortisol, right, you make the wrong decisions. Are they really wrong? Or you make decisions that are just, you know, not really well thought out.
I wonder whether, you know, sort of the reluctance to take medication, you know, in your mind was also associated that this is the easy way out. And just really, I mean, for our listeners, there's no easy way out with meds. Not all medications work. And sometimes there's a trial and error period and just side effects. But what medication will help you, sometimes it lifts some of the anxiety. It can lift your mood. It makes it easier for you to reflect on things and to understand what's going on. It doesn't change your thoughts. You know, there's no magic pill. It just makes it a little bit easier for you to, you know, do the inner work that that you were talking about.
You're right. It doesn't change your thoughts and it didn't change me. What it did was it allowed me to rediscover who I really was without panic and without anxiety.
So you said you were on it for 6 months. I mean, I'm really impressed by the way you pumped 4 months worth of milk.
It was insane.
And I think one of the things is, you know, not the fact that many women are, you know, the latest National Health and Morbidity Survey found that over 90% of women who have perinatal depression don't know it. They're unaware that they have the depression. And there you are, you know, struggling with anxiety and the depressive thoughts and a little bit of the existential questions, but then having to make these medical decisions.
Exactly.
It's a lot to take on rather than, as you mentioned, kind of prevention and knowing some of the facts early. And were you not aware of perinatal depression before that? Or did it take you by surprise?
Oh, of course I was aware of it. I did all the reading. I had the books and everything. In my head, from what I read and what I'd seen and in movies and in TV and what people shared with me, I was expecting like, wake up in the hospital, start crying, be really like panicky, is my daughter alive or not? And that would be the so-called script and feelings. It was nothing like that. Like I said, I was like, after I gave birth, I came home. I really don't remember the first 2 months. And that's quite telling, isn't it? Nobody talked about like loss of, how would you say, memory due to, it's like shutdown mode. It's like, I was so anxious and so depressed that I didn't even know I was. That is damn scary. And I think that's how I existed for 2 months. And then one day, like I said, when I went to watch the movie, it triggered the on button for me to be able to actually see what I was going through suddenly. That's pretty scary. That's like watching a movie in with the sound off and then suddenly having the sound full blast. And that's what happened to me that night. I could actually see, hang on a second. I started feeling like my hands went cold, the sweat kicked in, the heart went up. And I was thinking, well, this is not a normal response to just watching a movie. That's disturbing. I mean, we've seen a lot of disturbing movies. And it was almost like I said, it just woke me up. And then I was
aware. That something is not
yes.
right. Right.
But it'd been
Did
2 months,
anyone around
yeah?
you notice that something
no, no, because I'm like the master of deception, man. I was like makeup, tonguing my hair, looking cool. I was like, the mother is like, I'm losing weight. Look at me. I got this all under control. Check out my 5 different brands of like breast pumps. I know my daughter is so cool. We're all so cool. Like, yeah, right. You know, you're thinking that you're okay. But I knew there was something not quite okay because I would wake up every night at 3 or 4 a.m. for 2 months, just feeling like, and then I told myself, oh, remember the books and the movies that said that this would be normal, that you would wake up and you'd be worried about your child, and maybe you have a little minor postnatal depression. It's okay. But no, when you wake up with the sheets soaking wet on your back and your hands are wet and your feet and your heart's pumping out of your mouth, maybe that's not normal, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking, you know, and then I had some strange doctor characters. I've called them doctor characters because they're not very doctor-like, who would say, oh, just here, take these hormone medicines. You'll be fine. We'll balance out your hormones. It's not something that you need to worry about. Here, take some estrogen, take some progesterone. We'll balance it out. And that just was even worse because that's not the core problem here, right? We need to go through what we need to go through, but I just needed to understand. Once I understood, I've got postnatal severe depression, borderline heading into the anxiety that could lead to momentary psychosis. Psychosis is not a permanent thing, people. It can actually be helped with a intervention. But they were like, oh, no, this is just a hormonal thing. You'll be fine. And I'm like, I cannot breathe. How can I be fine? So there were a lot of interventions by people who actually didn't really know what they were doing, which is scary. And I know a lot of mothers experience this. And that's the reason why I'm sharing this today, so that other people don't, you know, after they give birth, feel like they go, instead of going to a psychiatrist and a psychologist, perhaps straight away, they're going to like fix their hormones. Don't do that first. Go in, go talk to a person who is well-versed and understands perinatal or postnatal conditions rather than mm-hmm. someone who only understands hormones, because it, and not everybody's hormones the same. If you're carrying a lot of trauma or you're going through various things in your life, it's not going to be just about hormones.
And that's one of the maybe fallacies about only focusing on the physical aspect, is people think that, you know, perinatal depression is only for moms, right? Because moms obviously the hormones. Yeah. But now we know that a lot of it has to do with this big role transition. As you said, a lot of new things are happening in your life, yes. obviously in your body, but also, you know, you have a new child to take care of. And so dads also experience perinatal depression. It's not a women's thing only. It's not because of your estrogen levels. It's that this is a really challenging period for many parents out there, and both moms and dads can develop depression during this time.
Yes, and in the same way that people who experience chronic illness or, you know, life-changing, life-altering illnesses that affect their inner and their outer, like, for example, cancer that might require removal of certain body parts, etc., or dialysis or a blindness or whatever, you know, that people, you know, God help everybody who goes through it, have to go through. It is the same with pregnancy. It is not as a disease as such, but it does change your body and it does leave scars. Let's be honest, whether it's a C-section or not, it does put the body through intense pain somehow, whether or not you have a painkiller or not, the body knows what you're going through. And it does change your mind and your body, your hormones, your entire system. So it should be treated with the same amount of respect and knowledge and support that any other life-altering health condition is treated with. Because, you know, if you were to tell somebody that, you know, you had, let's say, early stage cancer, the response to that is immediately, you need to see a doctor. You need to get help. We need to get you on medication. We need to get you treatment. How can I help you? Do I send you food to the house? Who's taking care of your kids? But you tell somebody that, you know, I came out of surgery, be it C-section or natural birth, and my hair's falling out, my life's falling apart. I can't think, I can't hold my child, I'm sweating, I'm shaking, I don't feel like myself, I have thoughts of impending doom, I think I'm going to die. And they go, oh, you'll be fine. Just give it time. And I mean, how ridiculous is that?
It helps, but I don't think it's the cure, you know? This is a question, I think. The media is one of the biggest culprits for this, and I know as someone in media, I'm going to push this a little bit on, push this button with you, is that they only highlight scary cases, you know, like really unfortunate cases where someone is often untreated with their untreated perinatal depression. As most people with perinatal depression are not violent They are scared they're going to be violent, but they actually don't turn violent. But, you know, there are a lot of negative consequences to that. And so it becomes scary. What would you say with someone who says, well, you know, if you got depression, then you shouldn't have a baby at all? You know, like, what would you say?
Oh, my goodness. That's like telling somebody, you know, oh, you got cancer, or, you know, you lost your sight and you lost your limb or your hand. You had an injury or you can't walk anymore. So therefore, you should just not bother doing anything. I mean, you, no matter what somebody is going through, physical or mental, the objective is not, it is to survive and then it is to thrive. I mean, the objective of being a human being is to thrive if you can. I mean, if you're fortunate enough. I mean, God helps so many people who are trying to survive. And of course, that's another subject another day with, you know, do you choose to have children if you, you know, are not able to take care of them, etc. But again, you know, we're talking about specifically perinatal today and being in that situation as a mother. And you know you're going to be a mother, or you are a mother, or you've just been a mother. And that's a decision you've made already. So, you know, let's work from there. So therefore, you know, people, our society saying, well, don't have a child is kind of like I said, saying to somebody who's in any other way suffering from something difficult, like they, you know, audio or visually impaired, and saying, well, you shouldn't do anything then. You know, because we as society,
if the illness kind of like dehumanizes you or makes you absolutely worthless.
Or makes you incapable, or you know, don't you dare make it difficult for us. Like, how dare you make it difficult for society? I mean, why do we have to take care of you? Like, we wouldn't say that to someone who had any other condition. But why do we say that to people with a condition that is mental health driven or, you know, caused by or related to? I mean, like I said, you know, somebody's born without a certain body part or born with a health condition, or someone has diabetes or kidney problem, you wouldn't say to them, well, don't have kids, because they could die just as much as a person with perinatal or postnatal or depression or anxiety could too. If we're talking about inconvenience, or we look at the effect on the impact of, you know, society and productivity or the happiness in a household, all types of conditions cause, you know, issues and difficulty and, you know, are actually an inconvenience. Let's be honest about it. But we don't go around telling people, and we don't have the right to say, you know, you shouldn't live or thrive in your life just because it's going to be hard. You know, so.
And I think that attitude neglects to say that perinatal depression or anxiety is highly preventable, highly treatable, right? It's not a death sentence. It's,
I mean, I wouldn't be talking to you right now.
The problem is that it's not often treated. You know.
Yeah, and then we've got a trickle down effect on society where, you know, people may not link it, but let's look at divorce rates, domestic violence rates. Let's look at child abuse. Let's look at mortality rates for everybody in a family, be it children, husbands, spouses, whoever it is. I mean, it's not like no husbands suffered from their wives' untreated postnatal depression. Many have worldwide, and the same goes for children. When their mother is suffering it, and the babies who are born to it, and the whole of society and the places these mothers work in are not getting them, they're not getting their best, their product. Everybody's suffering because society is kind of pretending that it's not a real issue that can be prevented and can be cured. And if everybody were to look at it in the same way as you would look at any other illness and go, okay, you've got this now, let's kick into what needs to be done, then we'd be much better off, because then we wouldn't waste so much time on questioning, is this really what you think?
Like,
you
would never question. Like blaming or like questioning rather than just moving to helping and supporting.
I mean, if we could get to understanding and accepting postnatal or perinatal conditions in the same way we have accepted cancer and diabetes, my goodness. The world would be a different place. The babies and the children
place.
And the, of course, the babies, the children, the spouses, the family units, the work, the bosses, the everybody would gain. Because if the woman is helped in the society, the woman who brings the life into life, the whole of that society benefits. And again, it's like, why isn't this just accepted and treated? Just like any other sickness or illness, you know, and that is something that I really want to see shift. And it's become my passion, because I was one of the lucky ones. You know, and it's like anything in life. Once you survive something, you wish it for everyone else. You wish for everybody else to survive and thrive, because that's where I'm at. And I'm very lucky because I had access to the support, the resources, and I had the knowledge, you know, in the back of my head to step out of the cinema that night and say to my husband, not let's go see a BOMO or let's go, you know, drink it away or let's ignore it. I had the knowledge that kicked into my head that said, you have to go now and hand over the reins and ask for some help. Just like if you lost your sight suddenly, you wouldn't just sit there and say, maybe it will come back, or maybe this is just a temporary thing, or somebody sent me black magic. You wouldn't. You would run to the doctor, and your family and your friends would support you in that. And the same goes for any mental health condition, whether you're pregnant, not pregnant, can be pregnant, cannot be. Why not see it in the same way, you know?
Thank you so much for your time and sharing your story. And it was just an incredible thing to listen to. I want to end on this note and maybe get your, you know, what do you want to say to people who have a really difficult time seeking help? And I really empathize with that. I found it difficult to seek help when I was depressed, and you found it difficult to seek help when you were depressed. And I don't want to be glib about it. I just seek a lot better for you.
No.
You know, so coming from that compassionate space, you know, what would you want to say to new and expecting moms who feel like, you know, something's not quite right, but are afraid to seek help?
The one thing that I kept saying to myself, and I said to myself, because ultimately, whenever you're going through anything in life, be it a death, a sickness, an illness, or whatever life-changing situation, not your spouse, not your family, not your friends can get into your head. Only you're in your own head, right? You know your thoughts. You know what you're capable of. So that means you can take yourself out of it and you can seek out the resources. You have the power in yourself, with the knowledge now, to seek out the resources that can help you to thrive. And you deserve more than to survive. Everybody deserves more than to survive. Everybody deserves to thrive in their lives. So don't make excuses for your right to thrive. Don't make excuses for yourself to suffer. You don't have to, you don't need to, and you shouldn't have to. So you can do it. Once you have the knowledge, you have the right to thrive, and you can get those resources, and you have the right to, because that's something I didn't think I did. I thought I shouldn't, I don't deserve it, and I need to fight through this myself.
Well, thank you very much. On that note, thank you for having, thank you for coming. No, I was going to say thank you for having me, but I'm
here. Well, you are. You're actually in my house, right? Through this, and I'm in yours.
So thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me. And I look forward to talking to you again soon. And I really hope that all the mothers or mothers-to-be and the fathers and society took something away from today.
Thank you for listening to the Being Human podcast. To find out more about Relate Malaysia's online therapy services, visit us at www.relate.com.my or email us at inquires@relate.com.my. You can also find us on Facebook and Instagram. Until next time, remember, we are all more human than we are otherwise. Be kind to yourself and take care.